and welcome to episode 2 of Not Shallow, the podcast. I'm Rebecca Collins. How are you guys today? How are you doing? I'm doing okay. I just ate some raspberries because I heard that berries are good for you. And I'm ready to talk. If you hear any meowing in the background, it's my cat Jones. There's nothing that can be done about him. He's having a rough day. So just ignore the cat behind the curtain. I want to jump right into it and tell you that I gave into my curiosity and started watching the TV show Younger. Have you heard of this show? I don't think it's very popular. It's on TV Land because I guess they ran out of reruns of Hogan's Heroes and Green Acres and had to start creating original content. So now we have Younger. And the show is written and produced by Darren Star of Sex and the City fame. I was a huge SATC fan back in the day. I'm talking all the seasons and both of the movies, even though I think I saw the second one mostly through the cracks of my fingers as I cringed in my seat because, let's face it, that one was demoralizing. So in case you haven't heard of Younger because you have taste or you have a full life or, you know, you got stuff going on, here is the plot in a nutshell. Liza Miller is a 40-year-old woman. She has a daughter in college, but the daughter is safely tucked away in India, studying abroad, as daughters do. And Liza's getting divorced. She's leaving her spacious suburban New Jersey home to start over because she caught her husband cheating on her. And when she can't get a job because she hasn't had a job in forever, it's that old catch-22, she decides to pose as a 26-year-old and immediately lands a job as an assistant at a publishing house. And she meets a hot guy in Brooklyn, where all the hot guys are, and his name is Josh, and they start seeing each other. So now her entire life is built upon a lie. And so it's, how will she pull this off? Should she pull it off? Is she a terrible person? And I'm going to tell you that this show is not without its charms and its laughs. And I also know that it should outrage me on a number of levels. And I do feel some waves of outrage as I watch, which must be why I keep watching, because I kind of enjoy that. So, you know, the level one of outrage is the obvious that an older woman has to pretend to be young to get anywhere in life, to get a job, to get a hot guy to have sex with her, to have any fun. And I can't watch the show and help but wonder, how would it all work? Would it even be possible if a man was in the lead of this role? So a 40-year-old man pretending to be a 26-year-old bro. And I actually think that that show would be more interesting on so many levels. But there's also the way that Liza is in the world. She's clueless about social media, the latest lingo, celebrities. This woman is not just 40. I think she's secretly Amish. She walks around saying things like, "What's a hashtag?" I mean, that's not her inflection. That's me being rude. But, you know, you're only allowed to say that kind of stuff if you teach medieval studies at Oxford or something. You know, you're that out of touch. And Liza wants to work in publishing, which is also, you know, a cliched woman thing to do, especially marketing and publishing. You know, she's not trying to become a financial analyst. She's not upset because she's having trouble learning to code in PHP. She wants to be in marketing and publishing. And once she makes it into her job, she's tasked with thinking of, you know, really banal things to do to promote women authors, which I think it's kind of interesting that they're promoting women authors on this show quite a bit. But she sets up a Twitter account for Jane Austen and she creates a viral campaign to promote Joyce Carol Oates to young readers by having them tweet photos of themselves topless, which is, you know, the perfect marketing campaign for Joyce Carol Oates, if there ever was one. Although that makes me feel, you know, kind of dirty just even telling you about these things she's doing. Like, so embarrassed that I'm watching this show, but I'm into the show now. So, you know, I'm not going to give it up. I have to see, you know, where does it go? Where do we end up here? She meets this guy, Josh, in a bar, and she can't bring herself to tell him she's 40. There's not really a reason to be dishonest, because he approaches her and he's flirting with her and he never asks her age, but she's so insecure that she lets him think she's 26. And I think we might need to take Liza's over 40 card away from her. If you don't know what that is, you probably obviously don't have one, but it entitles you to a lot of great freebies. Like, you get a free donut every other Friday, and they give you, you know, cool boots to wear, expensive purses, things that you enjoy. I mean, what I mean is that when you're over 40, you need to own it. And if you can't own it, you're just pathetic. And saying things like, did you know Cameron Diaz is over 40? She's not gross, right? Is pretty gross in itself. The actress who plays Liza is Sutton Foster, who really is 40 and who looks, you know, pretty stunning. She's tall, thin, great hair, great eyes, but she does not look 26. She's one of those women you would meet and you wouldn't be able to place her age right away. She's like this attractive, in-shape woman in your yoga class, and you get to talking and you just can't really tell, and you wonder, like, was she 34? Okay, maybe she's more like 38. But then you find out her real age, like when she invites you out for birthday drinks to, like, you know, a cool place where they have adult milkshakes. You might be surprised to find out that she's turning 41, but you wouldn't be shocked. You would just think, oh, yeah, I can see it. Good for her for looking so great. Plus, as far as passing for 26 goes, I like to think that women of a certain age just have this knowing presence about them, like an aura of wisdom that would make it impossible to be mistaken for someone in her 20s in a good way. I mean, you know a lot of things, and it's also impossible to keep cultural references from creeping into your conversations. I can barely make it through a day without making a joke about In Living Color or the Indigo Girls, or reminiscing about where I was during the infamous O.J. Simpson and the White Bronco car chase. And at one point, Liza has to warn her older friend Maggie not to make any references before 1990 in front of her new young friends, which would be so tiresome. And then let's consider for a moment the difference between sleeping with, you know, having sex with a 26-year-old woman versus a 40-year-old woman. And I mean, maybe the energy levels are different depending on a lot of things, but there's also something to be said for experience. So for a show like Younger to proclaim that Liza, who looks so cute in like boots and a short skirt and a little beanie hat, should be ashamed to proclaim that she's 40, where the hell does that leave the rest of us? We may as well go live in dugouts on the prairie. Should I take up quilting? Is life essentially over? Do you think Darren Star hates women? I'm beginning to wonder about that. I can tell you what Darren Star does not understand at all, and that is lesbians. I'm not saying I've got all the lesbian knowledge, but Liza's best friend, Maggie, who's played by Debbie Mazar, has to be a complete anomaly. She's an artist who has lived in Brooklyn forever. She has a big loft. We know she's an artist because that's really all she ever talks about, and she's always messing around with art supplies. And one time she was taking blue and green glass bottles and upending them onto the limbs of a twisted metal tree without comment. And it raised a lot of questions for me, like, Is that art or craft? Is that for a gallery show or the summer art fair at the park? And in another episode, Josh, the hot boyfriend, trips over a bag of trash in her loft and apologizes for, you know, tipping over the trash. And she says, "That's not trash. That's my art." And there's not one scene in which Maggie is hanging with her lesbo besties. You know, no girlfriends, no ex-girlfriends. The only friend is Liza, her hetero friend. Or she's hanging out in her big loft alone, drinking a glass of wine or something in a mug, which I really hope is moonshine. And if there's one thing I do know about lesbians is that they have friends. They like to form human connections. And an over 40 lesbian in New York City, who's lived in New York City forever, is going to have a lot of friends. You guys, trust me on this. She would be so busy. And Liza's new friends, the young ones, aren't all that intriguing. There's Kelsey, who's played by Hilary Duff. She's this on-the-rise, publishing house, whatever, with an emotionally controlling boyfriend. And I'm just waiting for the very special episode where that explodes. And then there's Kelsey's friends who, you know, they fit these prerequisites for being young today. Comfortable with your body, so you just take your top off at a busy park during lunch. You know, way into social media, into threesomes, going around saying you're 60% gay. You know, check off those boxes. Check off those boxes, girls. And as much as Liza is being portrayed as a skittish old dolt, scurrying around the office in fuzzy vests and boots, I'm not sure the young women on this show are getting a fair shake either. A small part of me wonders if this show isn't just a little brilliant in its setup. Because as much as it gets wrong, there's a tiny thing it gets right when it comes to aging and acting your age. And that's that for some of us, the lines are getting pretty blurred. Some people over 40 act like they've been lobotomized. You know, no hopes or dreams, slave to the to-do list or the corporate ladder and the activities of their children. Imagine, you know, they're marching to their deaths. And when Liza does go out on a date with an age-appropriate man, he's perfectly boring. He wants to talk about work, his ex-wife, checks his email, and then he makes this snide remark about how when he first considered going out with her, he thought she would be a horror show because she's so old. Which reminded me of an incident that happened to me. I was temporarily living in South Carolina eons ago, and I went to a dance club in Charleston. I have no idea why. And a guy danced up to me, sort of this military good old boy. And for some reason, I can't recall, he asked me how old I was. And I shouted back over the music, which was the song "Come and Ride It," parentheses, "The Train" by Quad City DJs. You can go YouTube that. I said I was 23 because I was 23. This didn't happen last year and I wasn't lying. And he said, "You look pretty good for 23. I mean, really, ladies, can we ever be young enough for some of these guys? So maybe if I'm being generous, there's a part of younger that's subversive, pointing out how we as a society and a culture have created this vacuum for ourselves once we're into middle age. And we aren't sure now what that really means. What do you do if you want to start over when you're middle age and you're facing all the expectations other people have for you? And none of them fit the program you want for yourself. And it's so overwhelming that you decide you need to put on a mask. Or in the case of Liza, you know, get some life-altering highlights and be someone else. If we decide to be younger, if not in body, then in mind, Does time assume a new shape for us? Does our entire experience of time need to be linear? I know that as I get older, time doesn't mean what it used to. It's in fast forward now, and another year is gone. My birthday is actually just days away. I kind of wonder how, you know, a summer when I was a kid used to feel like it lasted 2 years, and now a year passes in a month. And yet I can point to so many ways that I'm not old at all, you know, barely aging, you know, still wondering if barrettes are an option for me. And if you ask me how old I think I am, if I didn't know how old I actually am, I think I would say at the most 30 without hesitation. You know, maybe I'm being too generous about younger. This is still TV land after all. But it does remind me of another show that died a too soon death, but it's the perfect antidote or maybe answer to younger. And I'm talking about the canceled HBO show Enlightened, starring Laura Dern as Amy Jellicoe, who is an executive who's also 40 and trying to get her life back together. And I think this show perfectly rode the line between pathos and comedy, not taking itself too seriously, but definitely taking on all the crap that comes with starting over when everyone is telling you it's too late, it's impossible, or you're unworthy of redemption. And at the end of one of the episodes, I remember there was a voiceover by Amy, and she's telling us something that she probably learned while she was in her rehab program for anger management. And they're showing these images of flowers in this blown out sunlight on a very sunny afternoon. And she's telling us that there is time. You know, contrary to everything you've heard and that panicky feeling and the sense that, you know, past 40, we're just doomed to wander around filled with regret and asking younger people what hashtags are, there is time. There is so much time. Last week, I was reading an interview Frank Sinatra gave to Playboy magazine in 1963. And in the interview, Frank said, "When I sing, I believe. I'm honest. If you want to get an audience with you, there's only one way. You have to reach out to them with total honesty and humility. This isn't grandstand play on my part. I've discovered, and you can see it in other entertainers, when they don't reach out to an audience, nothing happens." Then he made a comment about broads that I'm going to skip over. But he went on to say, "This goes for any kind of human contact, a politician on television, an actor in the movies, or a guy and a gal." So I started thinking, what about a gal being totally honest about her former relationship with bodysuits? Maybe it's time for me to come clean about an old love affair I had in the 1990s with the bodysuit. First, I should define my terms. I'm not talking about exercise or dance apparel here, although the casual bodysuit was definitely ballet-inspired. I'm talking about a leotard that basically functions like a shirt and has a snap, or a set of snaps, actually, in the crotch. So it's a one piece, no buttons or zippers. Just get the thing over your head, pull it down, and get it snapped in place in your crotch. Then you put on your jeans, or your skirt, your what have you, and your shirt is perfectly tucked in, perfectly form-fitting. Bodysuits were popular in the 1970s, and then again in the early to mid-1990s. I'm not sure what sparked their resurgence or why they died off again, But that's sort of like asking, why did dinosaurs exist? Why did they have to go away? The simple answer is that there are bigger forces at play here. My starter bodysuit was from J. Crew. I ordered it from the catalog. It had long sleeves, it was olive green, and I thought it was the perfect mix of East Coast sporty and slightly sexy. About the sexy level I was comfortable with then. I believe I acquired this bodysuit at some point during my freshman year of college, and it tipped off what can only be described as a bodysuit firestorm. By sophomore year, I had over a dozen of them. They became my preferred bar shirt. They were the party outfit of choice on my dorm floor that year, which consisted of me and a posse of friends. Our weeks were structured like this. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, class and studying. Of course. Then Wednesday night, ladies' night. Thursday night, the weekend started. We went out Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights without fail. And all of this going out required a lot of bar shirts and party outfits. We would take trips to the mall just to go bar shirt shopping. Our favorite store was Contempo Casuals. And bodysuits were where we made some of our heaviest investments. You could say we were highly leveraged in bodysuits. So I wanted to share my top three bodysuits. First, a short sleeve number was blue and cream striped with a scoop neck. I loved it because I thought it made me look Parisian. Two was a long-sleeved black velour bodysuit with a very subtle pattern to it. It also kind of looked like velvet, but it wasn't high maintenance like velvet. I mean, you could throw it in the washing machine. It had a higher neck. It just looked sophisticated to me. And like something you would wear for a higher class night out. Not that I was having any, but I liked knowing it was there. And if there's one bodysuit I mourn the loss of, it's this one. I maintain I could still be rocking this bodysuit today. Third was a tank top bodysuit, also black, slightly ribbed. It had a crisscross tie on the chest. Sort of like the shoelaces on a tennis shoe. So you could have it cinched tight, or you could relax it a little bit, let it hang loose, kind of depending upon your mood, how the night was going. And that was one of my go-to bodysuits. To slip on a bodysuit during this time period, pairing it with some baggy jeans and a belt, or even better, overalls, was to be on the prowl. My friends and I formed what I like to think of as the bodysuit brigade, and we had a certain swagger when we were wearing our bodysuits. We freely traded them back and forth because if someone was in need, it was an unspoken rule that you had to step up with just the suit they required. My maroon one, Julie's black one, Gina's low-cut red one, whatever it took. There was a drawback to the bodysuit, especially if you were into partying, and by that I mean drinking, as much as we were. I'm talking about peeing. Peeing was a very complicated effort. If you were out at a bar or a party drinking and wearing a bodysuit, you needed to calculate exactly how long you could go before you would have to pee. How much did you want it? We subscribed to the don't break the seal philosophy, which said that you don't go to the bathroom until it is about to run down your leg. Because once you go, you're going to have to go again and again because you broke the seal. And we really believed this. I would wait hours to pee. But I had a good reason. Because if you're drunk and in a tiny, filthy bathroom stall at a bar, or in some squalid bathroom in a college apartment, it is not easy to get a bodysuit unsnapped, pulled up, pants down, pee while hovering over the toilet seat, because you did not want to touch it, get the bodysuit, which had a lot of elastic woven into it, back down and snapped. The snapping was the hard part. Sometimes you'd be so drunk your fingers were numb and you couldn't feel exactly what you were accomplishing down there. And sometimes you snapped it wrong and you had to start over, or you only got one snap back into place, and then you'd be back out at the party and you'd feel it give way. And it could take forever to get this thing secured. And there was always someone pounding on the door, and you would realize that not only were you too wasted to get your bodysuit back in place, but that tomorrow was going to be a very bad, painful day. But for the most part, the bodysuit brigade did not let this stop us or get us down. We thought we had a certain reputation to uphold. We'd all pile into the party and take it over, playing drinking games, being loud, tossing our hair around. We had a lot of hair. And I remember one party, we were really into this song, All That She Wants by Ace of Base. I know this is the lesser of the Ace of Base hits, but that's what we were into. And I remember we just kept taking over the stereo and blasting this song and dancing around in a circle in our bodysuits. It's etched in my memory. And I know that this, if this was on video, if I stumbled on this on YouTube, I would not be able to watch this. Let's not forget that bodysuits are sort of onesies for adult women. Is there any dignity really in this item of clothing? I mean, were we babes or were we babies? I have no idea. But it was a lot of fun. She leads a lonely life. She leads a lonely life. Shortly after I recorded that last story, I was in a department store and Ace of Base came over the loudspeakers or the stereo system or whatever you call the mechanism by which stores blast music at you while you shop. I saw the sign, Not All That She Wants, but still it made me supremely happy. It's like I'm part of the zeitgeist or something. Plus I needed a little bit of a pick-me-up after being panhandled while shopping for underwear. I was deep in ladies' lingerie and undies when suddenly this guy appeared out of nowhere. I was holding a flowered pair of hipsters in one hand and a more daring graffiti print pair of bikinis in the other. And I heard the familiar, excuse me, miss, which is always the opener. And when I looked up at him, he asked me for a dollar. And I told him, I don't have any cash, which is true. I never carry cash on me because I spend it all. I wanted to ask him so many things, like how he came to decide to go up to women's intimate apparel on the fourth floor to do his panhandling. Or maybe I should have asked him which pair of undies he thought would look better on me. But he had already moved on. Well, I wanted to leave you with a list today, and I've been doing some online research into the pets of old Hollywood. I just love pets. And I like seeing the publicity shots of old Hollywood stars with their dogs and cats and monkeys and lemurs. Because in these photos, their smiles look genuine. Even stars need that unconditional love. So, without further ado, a roll call of some of the stars of yesteryear and their beloved pets. Elizabeth Taylor, Amy, a Cocker Spaniel. Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. Harvey, a boxer. Rita Hayworth had Pookles, another Cocker Spaniel. John Barrymore reportedly had a vulture named Maloney, although I'm not sure I believe that one. Natalie Wood, Morningstar, the poodle. Liza Minnelli had John Cook, another poodle that she had as a child. Buster Keaton had Elmer, the St. Bernard, and Trotsky, an Irish wolfhound. Audrey Hepburn had Mr. Famous, Yorkshire Terrier, and also, quite famously, Pippin, her pet deer. Roy Rogers had Bullet, the German Shepherd. Joan Crawford had Baby and Princess, both dachshunds. Rudolph Valentino had Kabar, the Doberman Pinscher. I actually think he had many large dogs. Betty Grable had Genghis Khan, the Great Dane. Clark Gable, Bob, a German short-haired pointer, and also Rover and Noodles, also dachshunds. Vivian Lee, New Boy, and Pooh Jones, both Siamese cats. Vivian Lee was a huge cat lover. And I'll close on a personal favorite, President Calvin Coolidge. I know he's not a Hollywood star, but he has one of the coolest pets of all time, a pet raccoon named Rebecca. Rebecca was sent from Mississippi to be part of the White House Thanksgiving dinner in 1926, but she was so friendly and so docile and so just downright adorable that they decided to keep her rather than eat her for dinner. May all Rebeccas everywhere be treated with the same amount of respect and admiration as Rebecca, the presidential raccoon. Until we meet again,